Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Daniel Bender, standing in for Coral Lee. This episode is part of a special series in collaboration with Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. Our new issue features special sections on ingredients, from salmon to chicken, taste and technology in East Asia, and excursions on exploration of food and mobility. As well, Gastronomica continues to publish its COVID dispatches, short portraits of responses to the food crises of this pandemic. For the next 6 weeks, join special hosts from Gastronomica Editorial Collective as we talk with issue editor authors. My guest this week is Colline Ferrand. Colline is a PhD candidate in sociology at Sciences Po and Northwestern University. She has written broadly about food, class, and work in cities from Chicago to Santiago to Paris. Thank you for joining us from Paris today, and welcome to the show. Pleasure. Colline, in this particular moment of the pandemic and the food crises it has provoked, and we'll come back to that hopefully towards the end of our discussion, we're hearing a lot in the term food deserts. It seems to show up all over the place, in ordinary conversation, in policy documents, newspaper accounts, and more. But let's pause. Perhaps you can define the word, the term food desert all over again.
Right. So with the framework of food desert, it's the notion that in a disadvantaged neighborhood, the food supply is limited to fast foods or unhealthy options in a broad sense. And so in this context, neighborhood characteristics are assumed to have negative consequences on residents' nutritional outcomes and over the effects of individual characteristics.
By contrast, we don't hear the term, you use the term in your wonderful submission, we don't hear the term food oases very much in ordinary conversation. What do you think how might you define that term for us?
So food oasis might be just the reverse. So the notion that for residents of neighborhoods with a rich and diverse food supply, so the fact of living in those neighborhoods will have positive consequences on the residents' nutritional outcomes and again over the effects of individual characteristics.
Now, your article entitled "Food Desert or Food Oases: Insights from Mexican Chicago." Challenge how we use these terms and give us a sense of how much these terms are being used in ordinary parlance, as well as in how, for example, policymakers understand neighborhood food access. Mm. As you were just offering a definition of a food desert, it struck me that part of the understanding of food desert there was an implication, something negative about the food system as a whole. But do you think in the way we use food desert, the way it is often just ordinarily used, do you think there's a little bit of blame that gets placed on local residents?
Yeah, right. So we are blaming the residents. And first we are blaming the neighborhoods, but by extension, by association, the neighborhood residents for their obesity. So there's definitely an element of victim blaming in that framework.
Now, before you tell us some more about alternative ways in which we should understand neighborhoods like Mexican Chicago, can you tell us a little bit about your research methods? How did you go about conducting this fascinating research on Mexican Chicago?
So my methods are ethnographic. So I conducted both observation and in-depth interviews in two majority Mexican neighborhoods in Chicago, so Pilsen and Gage Park. So ethnographic methods, basically being on the field and talking to people.
So for those of us, I haven't been to Chicago for a very long time, not likely to go anytime soon, as I'm recording here from Toronto, Canada. For those who haven't visited this area of Chicago, can you just give us a little bit of an oral tour around the neighborhood? What does it look like? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? Who lives there?
Yeah, so the two neighborhoods, so Pilsen, Ain, and Gage Park. So Pilsen is represented as a quintessential Mexican neighborhood, so meaning a place of safety and entertainment, resources, food for the Mexican community in Chicago and in the Midwest in a broad sense. So you could think of it here as a quintessential Mexican neighborhood. And it's located quite close to the city center, actually. So hence a process of gentrification going on. So you have the mostly white upper middle class newcomers being attracted to Pilsen as both a neighborhood that is conveniently located within Chicagoland, and also, from the perspective of these white newcomers, also, a kind of an authentic place, right? Whereas from the perspective of the Mexican working class, yeah, it's mostly thought as a safe neighborhood and a neighborhood of a collective cultural uplift. So this is Pilsen, and the other neighborhood in which I conducted a fieldwork is Gage Park. So it's located precisely on the southwest side of Chicago. The housing stock is mostly bungalows. So it's you could visualize it as a typical residential neighborhood of the outskirts of a big American city, and it was originally a majority Irish neighborhood, but in recent decades, together with the steady labor migration from Mexico to Chicago throughout the 20th century, so in the recent decades, it became a majority Mexican neighborhood.
Go ahead.
No, just to summarize. So about Gage Park, you could think of it as a residential majority Mexican working class neighborhood.
Now, if you were walking down the street in not a residential street, but perhaps one of the more commercial streets in both of these different neighborhoods, what kind of shops might be there?
Mostly immigrant-owned shops. Immigrant, but not necessarily a Mexican, also Greek and Spanish, but in general, immigrant-owned shops that do supply fresh produce. Food shops that do emphasize the supply of fresh produce, and restaurants and cantinas as well.
So a desert with a fair number of trees, perhaps.
Absolutely.
When you set out for your research, was fruit deserts on your mind? Or as you talked to residents in these two neighborhoods, did you find yourself wondering about why these terms are used, perhaps from the outside?
It's interesting. I did not come to the field with the notion of food deserts in mind, but I was rather interested in the more general question of how do immigrants get to recreate their food practices in different locations. Something that I found interesting is that despite availability of of a fresh produce of foodstuff in their neighborhood, the residents of these two neighborhoods, so both Pilsen and Gage Park, we're still articulating crafting acquisition practices that span the Chicagoland. And so here I was like, this is interesting because if you think about the most famous notions of food access, so either food desert or food neighborhood, food desert or food oasis, are very much neighborhood centric, right? And so I guess my first approach was like, they seem to be living in a kind of a food oasis, but their food oasis seems to be Chicagoland in general and not just their neighborhood. So I was like, let's tackle the approach of food desert / food oasis as the dominant framework to understand the food access and acquisition in urban neighborhoods. And by means of the ethnographic method, let's try to complicate the framework and starting from people's perspectives and people strategies.
And I think you've done that in fascinating ways. And before we get into some of those implications, can I ask you a little bit, who were some of the people that you spoke to? How did you identify your informants?
I had the field ethnographic methods in general, in the sense that I was not trying to select people based on particular sociodemographics or age. I was just interested in the in Mexican neighborhoods, and then within I just talked to whatever people I was encountering, I was meeting in those neighborhoods. And this also, perhaps adds an element of contextualization for the case of Pilsen, right, which I told you about, because it turned out that in Gage Park, I was mostly meeting with local residents or residents of Gage Park, so the working class residential Mexican neighborhood. And in the case of Pilsen, by just, hanging out on the street and talking to people, I was also meeting a number of former residents of Pilsen, so Mexican first and second generation immigrants, but that then relocated to other neighborhoods across Chicagoland and particularly in the suburbs, but that was still getting back to Pilsen to buy groceries and to go to church, so to relieve the sense of the sense of a Mexican community in Pilsen, so their former neighborhood and also the quintessential neighborhood of Mexican Chicago.
So let me read you just one quote that just jumped out at me and for our listeners to hear the quote. You interviewed a U.S.-born community organizer who, as you put it, he said plainly, quote, "There's so much food here." Food in the middle of something that is a food desert. That line really struck out to me. I'm curious several things about that short, lovely quote. First, what was the question that you might have asked that provoked that response? But the other question is, there's a certain element of surprise. There's so much food here. Was he answering your response and perhaps answering back to city policymakers, to nutritionists, to whoever who might have been calling this neighborhood with so many shops a food desert? So I'm curious, what did you ask him that caused him with a little exclamation to say, "There's so much food here"?
If I remember well, it was in the middle of a conversation in which I was making the observation that I was meeting a lot of former residents who were getting back to the neighborhood to buy their groceries. And so the reaction was like, yeah, but this is because there's just so much food here, so much diversity and variety of options.
Well, it is remarkable that people are coming back to buy groceries to a place that is still represented as a food desert. What is it about? On some level, the absence of a mainstream supermarket sometimes can label a place as a food desert. Why is it that the small stores that this one community organizer was coming back to shop at, what is it about small stores ingredients, perhaps from places like Mexico, seem invisible to those who are deciding whether a place is or is not a food desert.
But just to clarify, I mean, by the city of Chicago, neither Pilsen nor Gage Part is labeled as a food desert. But if that term was actually used by the, you know, white upper middle class newcomers that I was interviewing, so you know, so some of them were referring to Pilsen as a food desert, in the sense that there is a supermarket in Pilsen called La Casa del Pueblo, but there is not you know, this type of a big brand supermarkets like Walmart or even Whole Foods. So in that sense, you know, I guess a white upper middle class newcomer could think of Pilsen as a food desert, but other than that, it's not labeled as a food desert. So neither by the city of Chicago, you know, institutionally, nor by the local Mexican residents.
That's a very interesting point about where a food desert is something that exists both in the imagination of perhaps those from outside of a community. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's in contrast to official policymakers. But to those kinds of residents, why don't those that the supermarket that you mentioned, to the small stores, why do they seem invisible to them? Is it a question of race? Is it a question of ingredients and the racialization of ingredients?
I guess it's a question of food preferences, because a major aspect of the food preferences and practices of Hispanics in general, and in the case of my study, Mexican first and second generation immigrants, is the emphasis on consuming and cooking from fresh produce, so meaning fruits, vegetables, and meat, and so these are produce that. These residents mostly acquire from small shops, right, and not necessarily from big supermarkets. Or if they do from big supermarkets, it's they mostly buy on special offer, right? And so in the institutional framework of food deserts, it's in most instances it's being you know, counted or quantified as you know, the number of supermarkets and hypermarkets. But here, you know, I point to the existence of small, in most instances, immigrant-owned shops as a major supplier of the preferred ingredients of this community, and so specifically fruits, vegetables, and meat. So produce, fresh produce.
We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with Colleen in just a moment.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
And we are back. This is Meant to Be Eaten with Daniel Bender, talking with Colleen Ferrand about her article, Food Desert or Food Oases, Insights from Mexico and Chicago, available in the current issue of Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. Colleen, right at the beginning of your paper, you ask a simple-sounding question, but one with profound implications. You ask, Are Mexican immigrants in Chicago able to find the products they grew up with and still love? What in the end did you find?
In the end, long story short, the answer is yes.
What kind of products were they looking for, and what were their reactions and when you talked to them as they described finding those kinds of products?
Yes, yeah, so the products they grew up with and they still love are mostly fresh produce, fruits, vegetable, and meat, and sometimes fish for those immigrants of coastal areas. And interestingly, they emphasize that in past decades, there was less availability of this fresh produce. But they do emphasize, in the case of mostly, long-time immigrants, that the availability of fresh produce has been increasing in past decades. And in two ways, so both in the variety of products per se, and also the variety of outlets that do supply these products. So they emphasize that they can find these products both at immigrant-owned shops, but they are also increasingly available in what they call American stores. So meaning big supermarkets.
Did you find a concern about the impact of gentrification among those of Mexican origin in places, in some of these neighborhoods? Did you find a concern, not just about the kinds of costs, but actually, say, the arrival of a smoothie shop that you described as perhaps leading to a kind of a food desert?
Residents felt the effects of gentrification as mostly in terms of housing. So meaning rising rents, and so people getting evicted from Pilsen and relocating to the suburbs. But they were not feeling so much the effects of gentrification, at least at this point, on the retail structure. And so in that sense, they were not really bothered. They did not care that much about the arrival of smoothie places or typical. What we think of typical stores for gentrifiers. They did not care them that much to the extent that they were still able to access their shops for them.
Did they feel an urge for a need for those kinds of the shops, that their shops, as you just put it, did they feel an urge or suggest that those shops needed to be protected, perhaps in the face of rising rents?
Yeah, like I said, in their words, they were really mostly concerned about about housing, so about the rents for everyday people, and so they were still finding contentment in being able to access their stores, and also they were mentioning these former neighbors of theirs who moved to the suburbs and who are still able to find find the produce that they want. Back in their neighborhood, so back in Pilsen.
Have you had a chance to share some of these research findings with some of the people that you interviewed?
No, not at this moment. But I do have the project of potentially collaborating with those community organizers that I did interview to share my findings with them.
And how might you go about doing that? Because it's such a fascinating project that you have, and you're asking such powerful questions about access to the right food, really is a question of food sovereignty. These seem like really important findings for all kinds of different stakeholders to hear.
Yeah, perhaps in the sense that, like I said, I did not feel so much of a concern when it comes to the shops because, the effects were not being really felt apart from the arrival of new gentrifiers' shops. But something that was, really emphasized by my informants was the need for their, I would say, their infrastructure of everyday life to persist, and relatedly the sense of community.
Now, inevitably, that these are questions that are very much on our mind. As I was walking down the street in my neighborhood here in Toronto, a largely Greek neighborhood in Toronto, and not having been on the main street for even a week, a whole series of shops have been newly boarded up. You mentioned the word persist, and here's a moment where inevitably, though you did this research before the pandemic hit, it must be very much on your mind, some of the shops, some of the shoppers. Can we revisit the neighborhood now? What news have you heard? What has changed?
No, I mean, nothing has really changed, you know, structurally since since the pandemic. In this, because these are, you know, these are all essential businesses. But perhaps the effects would be, you know, rather felt not in the short term, but in the long term.
Do you feel like, on some level, I mean, one of the concerns that I think that comes out of my reading of this, one of the concerns is, if these kinds of shops are so important to the Mexican Chicagoans who are shopping there, but are perhaps relatively invisible, perhaps to the gentrifiers, perhaps to larger city policymakers, these kinds of questions about access to the right food, to the food that people love, is also a fundamental question about how to maintain culinary infrastructure in a moment of real change, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking some questions here, and very important and very powerful questions, and questions about food access. Now, this seems like a good place for me to give you an opportunity. You've given us a sense of where the notions of food desert and food oases both failed to capture the different ways in which ordinary people go about finding their own lives, finding their own, the foods that they love and the foods that sustain them. Here's an opportunity, perhaps towards the end of our conversation here. Can you give us perhaps a better term that we might use to understand a neighborhood like Pilsen, Gage Park?
I mean, the first thing, I think the focus should be on the residents that, rather than the neighborhood, right? And so I would say, I would tweak the phrase as not a Pilsen period and a Gage Park period, but rather residents of Pilsen and residents of Gage Park, right? And then moving from, the static and spatially centered notions of food deserts and food oases to where the rather thinking about the creation of food access and acquisition.
I think that's a very important transition. Thank you so much, Colleen, for joining us. This is exciting work. And listeners can read the full article, Food Desert or Food Oases, Insights from Mexican Chicago, forthcoming in Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, Volume 20.4, which is due out in November 2020. For more details, visit gastronomica.org. Join us next week as we talk to Kyung Jin Bai about his fascinating history of soy sauce in Imperial and Colonial Korea. Thank you again, Colleen.
Thank you.
Meant to Be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.